Today is Friday, March 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Egypt continues trying to move a ship lodged in the Suez Canal.
Tugboats are trying to maneuver the nearly 400-meter Ever Given so that it is able to move once again.
Plus, tensions are on the rise between France and Turkey.
French President Emmanuel Macron signaled new trouble, accusing Turkey of meddling in France's presidential election due next year.
And looking at sustainable relationships between humans and the animal kingdom. We'll have these stories and more next. Egypt's Suez Canal authorities made further attempts on Thursday to reopen the waterway after unsuccessful efforts to move a massive cargo ship that's blocking a main artery. Edward Uranian starts us off.
With shipping traffic stalled for yet another day Thursday, Egypt's Suez Canal Authority continues to work against the clock to try and refloat a gigantic container ship that remains stuck. Usama Rabia, who heads the Suez Canal Authority, told Egyptian TV that tugboats are trying to maneuver the nearly 400-meter Ever Given so that it is able to move once again. He says weather conditions were responsible for the incident. The canal authority, he says, always tries to anticipate sand or wind storms so that ships are not likely to suffer damage from bad weather conditions. Some ships, he notes, were allowed to remain in one of the canal's lakes to remain safe. The container ship is longer than the width of the Suez Canal at the point where the vessel became wedged. Some sources say a wind gust was responsible for pushing the ship into the side of the canal. The Japanese company that runs the ship apologized to Egypt Thursday for creating a massive traffic jam. The vessel, which carries approximately 20,000 shipping containers, making it one of the largest in the world, can be destabilized by gusts of wind due to the number of containers stacked on top of each other. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the Washington-based U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that the current traffic jam on the Suez Canal, which is responsible for 12% of world trade, is likely to be a difficult and costly situation.
It is not going to be an easy operation. It's probably going to be an expensive one. It's already very expensive because so many ships have been blocked from going through. More than likely, there will be massive lawsuits from other shipping companies and people who expected their goods and parts to arrive on time.
Sullivan points out that unless canal authorities were negligent in advising the ship, Egypt is not likely to be responsible for what happened.
I don't think Egypt would be responsible for it unless some connection can be proven to not directing the ship properly or not mentioning the sandstorm coming through. But the real responsibility is going to be on the part of the ship itself. And Egypt will most likely find that shipping company and the people involved in this incident of very large sums.
Egypt earns between $5 and $6 billion each year in revenues from the Suez Canal. Sullivan says this is a great embarrassment to Egypt, and it is losing massive amounts in Suez Canal revenues from the current blockage. Arab media are reporting that the Suez Canal Authority has requested assistance from a company in the Netherlands, destination of the Ever Given, to help refloat the ship. VOA could not independently confirm the information. Oil prices have reportedly risen about $5 a barrel due to the blockage of the canal. Around 50 ships a day pass through the Suez Canal, but most traffic is hunkering down at various locations along the waterway. Many ship crews are reportedly very tired since host ports have not allowed them to leave their vessels because of the coronavirus pandemic. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Tensions are again rising between France and Turkey, and Nicolas Pineau is up next.
After weeks of a relative lull in the often rocky relationship between France and Turkey, French President Emmanuel Macron signaled new trouble, accusing Turkey of meddling in France's presidential election due next year. In an interview that aired Tuesday on French national TV, Macron accused Ankara of spreading lies through its state-controlled media and portraying France as having a problem with Islam.
Il y aura des tentatives d'ingérence pour la prochaine élection. C'est écrit. Les menaces ne sont pas voilées.
Macron asserted that Turkey will try to interfere with the next presidential election. He said the threats are real and called them unbearable. The French president said it does not want to restart a peaceful relationship with Turkey if those actions are ongoing. This is not the first time Western European leaders accused Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of engaging in such activities. In 2017, he came under criticism when he asked German citizens of Turkish origin to vote against parties supporting Chancellor Angela Merkel. This time is different, according to Didier Billon, deputy director at the French Institute for International and Strategic Affairs.
Surprise, de nouveau un ton très agressif de la part de Emmanuel Macron et surtout.
The researcher describes his surprise when he heard Macron's tone and unverified accusations about Turkey's meddling with the next French presidential election. Billon says he finds this statement hard to understand as Macron deeply engaged against Turkey throughout 2020, but without succeeding, as neither NATO nor the European Council took sanctions. The Turkish Foreign Ministry responded to Macron's remarks with a statement calling them dangerous, saying they alienate foreign communities in France. Other disputes between France and Turkey regarding Libya, Syria, Nagorno-Karabakh have also caused tensions between the two NATO allies. Last year, Erdogan even called for a boycott of French products over what he charged was Macron's negative attitude toward Islam and Muslims after a spate of terror attacks in France. Analysts say that overall, the relationship between Turkey and the French leadership has been deteriorating for the past 15 years.
La Turquie a fait beaucoup d'efforts au début du processus de négociation à partir de 2005.
Billion details the huge efforts and reforms made by Turkey in 2005 at the beginning of the integration process with the European Union. Then, around 2007-2008, he said Europeans started imposing harsh conditions, especially after French President Nicolas Sarkozy was elected, according to Billion. He says there was then a breaking point when Erdogan had enough and used those tensions with the EU to advance his nationalist agenda, becoming aggressive with the Europeans and insulting some of their leaders. Ankara and Washington have also been at odds over issues including Syria policy, human rights, and the Turkish S-400 missile defense acquisition from Russia. The purchase prompted the U.S. to impose sanctions and to remove Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu met U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Wednesday at the NATO summit in Brussels. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Turkey raised the issue of Uyghur Muslims during talks with China's foreign minister in Ankara Thursday. Reuters' Edward Baran has that story.
It came as hundreds of Uyghurs protested against the treatment of their ethnic kin in China. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met President Tayyip Erdogan as around 1,000 protesters gathered in Istanbul, chanting "Dictator China" and "Stop Uyghur Genocide, Close the Camps." Some waved blue and white flags of the independence movement of East Turkestan, the name by which the movement refers to Xinjiang.
We are here because of the freedom of Eastern Turkestan, for asking Chinese government to close the camps, stop genocide against Uyghurs.
China approved an extradition treaty with Turkey in December. With the deal awaiting ratification by Ankara's parliament, activists among some 40,000 Uyghurs living in Turkey have stepped up efforts to highlight their plight, holding regular protests in Ankara and Istanbul. Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, who has denied that the extradition accord would lead to Uyghurs being sent back to China, said after meeting Wang, he'd conveyed, quote, our sensitivity and thoughts on Uyghur Turks. He added that Ankara and Beijing would enhance cooperation against the COVID-19 pandemic and on vaccines. Uyghurs' worries have been fueled by Ankara's dependence on China for COVID-19 vaccines, having received 15 million doses from Sinovac Biotech and ordered tens of millions more.
Reuters reporter Edward Baran. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Security and economic tensions are rising in Lebanon after another failed attempt to form a new government. As businesses shut down, joblessness and hunger are rising. Lebanon's banks, having lent 70% of their assets to an insolvent central bank, have locked most depositors out of their savings. Analysts say that with no government budget, there will soon also be no hard currency to pay for imports of subsidized wheat, fuel, and medicine. Dale Gavlak takes it from here.
Political observers like Michael Young of Beirut's Malcolm H. Kerr Carnegie Middle East Center warn that Lebanon may be facing the worst moment in its post-war history. He says the beleaguered country, once known as the Switzerland of the Middle East, faces the potential multifaceted collapse of its financial system, its economy, and its security situation, with no effort by political leaders to prevent this. More Lebanese are slipping into poverty as their currency loses almost 90% of its value on the informal market in just 18 months. Economist Tawfiq Gaspard, a former senior economic advisor to the Lebanese Minister of Finance and a former advisor to the International Monetary Fund, spells out how Lebanon got into this dire crisis.
The policy of the Central Bank of Lebanon is the culprit, the criminal behind banking collapse. Fiscal policy brought the collapse of the exchange rate with unsustainable debt level. There is absolutely, totally no economic or financial solution in Lebanon before first we address the issue of occupation of Lebanon by Iran through their local arm Hezbollah. Lebanon's fundamental problem is political.
Young says many in Lebanon believe Hezbollah is behind the delay in forming a new government because the group is waiting to see the outcome of negotiations on an Iran nuclear deal. He says Lebanon is a hostage, ensuring that Washington accepts Tehran's and Hezbollah's domination there in any broader regional agreement. Meanwhile, Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri says he does not want to lead a government if his condition that technocrats form it is not accepted. So far, Hezbollah has refused the demand. Also, Young says observers in Lebanon believe Hariri's backer, Saudi Arabia, does not want him to act as a cover for Hezbollah. Robin Wright, a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Wilson Center, recently returned from Lebanon where she observed that Lebanese army soldiers are also suffering and going hungry like the rest of the population, raising a serious security threat.
The Lebanese army is the one institution that is functioning in this country that is almost a failed state. The warlords are no longer fighting each other militarily. They're fighting each other politically. So the Lebanese army is really critical. ISIS has tried once again to take advantage of that vacuum, and it has started to resurge after being pushed out of the eastern mountains on the Syrian border. Two sleeper cells have been captured this year. They think there are others.
The United Nations says that more than 55% of Lebanon's population is now trapped in poverty and struggling for bare necessities, as it warns of very severe domestic and regional repercussions. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
The final results from Israel's fourth election in 2 years show a nation deeply divided over whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should remain in office, with neither side having secured a governing majority. Israelis vote for party lists rather than candidates, and seats in the 120-member Knesset are assigned based on the percentage of the votes garnered. No single Israeli party has ever won a 61-seat majority, so an aspiring prime minister must assemble a ruling coalition. Those negotiations usually take weeks, and if no one is able to assemble a 61-seat majority, the country will go into an unprecedented fifth election later this year. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he's setting an ambitious new goal in the fight against COVID-19. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
His initial goal was administering 100 million vaccine doses in his first 100 days. After that happened last week, the president's doubling it.
200 million shots in 100 days.
It was his opening statement in his first news conference and the only reference to the pandemic. Instead, the president faced a barrage of questions on immigration, voting rights, and gun control.
We're going to move on these one at a time.
While leaving open the door to pushing for fundamental changes in Senate procedures to get his agenda through GOP opposition. He's also previewing 2024, saying for the first time he plans to run again.
That's my expectation.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden admitted Thursday that some 2,500 U.S. troops could still be in Afghanistan after May 1st, the agreed-upon deadline for American troops to leave the country under a year-old deal with the Taliban. Biden cited tactical reasons for the possible delay, but said that even if the United States does not meet the deadline, he could not envision U.S. troops staying in Afghanistan past next year. Biden initiated a review of the February 2020 deal between the administration of former President Donald Trump and the Taliban shortly after he took office. And while that review has yet to be formally completed, several high-ranking officials have questioned whether the Taliban have kept their side of the bargain. An attorney for jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny says that he is in poor health. The lawyer says that Navalny is suffering back pain and has virtually lost the use of one of his legs. Navalny's lawyer adds that pleas for him to be given necessary medicines were ignored for 4 weeks. Russian authorities say Navalny is in satisfactory condition, according to the French news agency. Navalny was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison in February on an embezzlement charge. One day after a silent strike that left the streets of many cities across Myanmar practically empty, demonstrators were out in force Thursday in a continued show of opposition against the ruling military junta. There are scattered reports of soldiers using force to break up protests in some southern cities. Soldiers also confronted protesters staging candlelight vigils across the country, with reports of at least one man being shot and killed. The local activist group Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says military forces have killed at least 286 people during the crackdown. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. AstraZeneca says its COVID-19 vaccine was 76% effective in a new analysis of its U.S. trial, only slightly lower than the level in an earlier report this week that was criticized for using outdated data. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has this update.
AstraZeneca also stressed its 85% efficacy in the over 65s. And 100% protection against severe disease and death. Those stats put it in the same ballpark as the other vaccines, an infectious disease expert told Reuters. What's also significant is that the trial of more than 32,000 people came after more infectious variants of the disease became prevalent. Thursday's revision should go a long way towards US emergency use authorization for the shot, which AstraZeneca will seek in the coming weeks. And it will help the firm, which developed the vaccine with Oxford University, overcome doubts over effectiveness and side effects on both sides of the Atlantic. AstraZeneca's vaccine is seen as crucial in tackling the spread of COVID-19. It is easier and cheaper to transport than rival shots, but questions have dogged the rollout. Earlier this month, more than a dozen countries paused use after reports linked the vaccine to a rare blood clotting disorder. The EU drug regulator ruled it safe, but many Europeans remain sceptical. Production glitches and export curbs by India and the EU are among other problems that have marred the rollout. Two sources have told Reuters that India has put a temporary hold on all major exports of the shot made by the Serum Institute of India, the world's biggest vaccine maker. That's to meet domestic demand as infections rise.
Lucy Fielder reports for Reuters News. The World Health Organization reports that Africa is lagging in the race to vaccinate its population against the deadly coronavirus. The WHO says the continent needs far greater access to COVID-19 vaccines to reach its goal of vaccinating 60% of the population by June of 2022. Lisa Schlein reports.
Africa received its first delivery of vaccines from the COVAX vaccine sharing facility a month ago. Health officials say this has kick-started robust vaccination campaigns throughout much of the continent. Richard Mahigo is an immunization and vaccine development program coordinator at the WHO Regional Office for Africa. He says 32 countries currently are vaccinating high-risk groups against COVID-19. So far, he notes, nearly 7.7 million doses have been administered.
This is indeed a good start, even if the continent has received only limited doses and much later than other regions of the world. The momentum just have started must be kept up to widen the scope of COVID-19 vaccination beyond the high-risk group that have been prioritized by many countries.
Mahigo warns this will not be possible unless vaccine equity becomes a reality. He says it is unfair for some high-income countries to vaccinate their entire populations while ignoring the needs of poorer nations. WHO estimates Africa will need nearly 1.5 billion vaccine doses to protect 60% of the continent's 1.2 billion population by June 2022. Another challenge facing Africa is the new coronavirus mutant strains. Mahigo says at least 15 African countries have reported the presence of variant strains. He says it is important to monitor the evolution of the new strains and to maintain public health measures such as masks and social distancing.
All the measures that were proven really effective in preventing the transmission should continue to be done. By increasing the vaccination capacity, we will put less pressure on the virus and avoid its mutation, as we have heard. So this is the only solution that we can have to get out of this situation.
Mahigo says WHO is exploring different ways of boosting the vaccine supply through the COVAX facility. One possible solution, he says, is to collaborate with rich countries and test their willingness to share surplus doses with Africa. Another is to promote technology transfer and reduce intellectual property barriers so vaccines can be produced locally. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A huge flood recovery operation is underway in eastern Australia as overflowing rivers continue to threaten homes. Phil Mercer reports two people have died and thousands of others have been forced from their homes.
Officials say two men were killed after being caught in floodwaters in the states of Queensland and New South Wales. Near Sydney, the body of a 25-year-old man from Pakistan was found inside a submerged car. Detective Inspector Chris Laird says the man called emergency services to say his vehicle was sinking before contact with him was lost.
A man that is possibly about to pass away and he's on the phone and the water's rising. Given what I've seen of the damage to the vehicle, it could very well be that the electrics totally failed and he was simply unable to escape from the car, which is an absolute tragedy.
The military is being brought in to help communities recover from some of the worst flooding Australia has seen in decades. Thousands of homes have been affected and many roads, bridges and rail lines damaged. Resident Angela Stewart was forced to leave her home north of Sydney. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the floods are the latest disaster to strike her community.
This is Australia, isn't it? We had all the bushfires within about 3 kilometres of our house last year. We thought this is the safest place to be during the COVID-19 pandemic. But then, you know, life has a tendency to equalise things out, doesn't it?
The torrential rain has eased across New South Wales, although some thunderstorms were forecast Thursday, and the flood risk is expected to continue into the weekend. Dozens of schools remain closed. On Wednesday, a group of campers was rescued by a military helicopter after roads were cut by floodwaters. Thousands of residents are being allowed to return to their homes to survey the damage from some of Australia's wildest storms in years. Several communities remain cut off by the flood waters, and supplies are being delivered by boat and helicopter. Australia is a land experienced with nature's extremes, but some of the downpours in recent days have been described as a once-in-a-century weather event. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, although Africa is famous for iconic species such as the rhinoceros, the elephant, and the lion, It's also home to many endangered wildlife species, such as the mountain gorilla, Grevy's zebra, the Ethiopian wolf, and the pangolin. Protecting these species while establishing sustainable relationships between them and their human neighbors will be key to the continent's future development. But some African conservationists are increasingly insistent that gaining the support of their fellow Africans will require experts and policymakers from the continent who have African sensibilities and points of view. Now, to learn more about what that may mean, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Kadu Sibwe Shabunya. He's the president and CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, the largest African-led international conservation organization that focuses exclusively on the continent. Mr. Shabunya began by criticizing the outsized influence European and American NGOs have on how wildlife is cherished and conserved.
We cannot afford to continue having conservation on the continent led by foreigners. Majority of NGOs and efforts to conserve wildlife is led by foreigners. The few Africans are white Africans. We need black Africans that support conservation on the continent to grow our constituency.
I know at the African Wildlife Foundation, you've had a lot of experience with this.
Absolutely. I've met so many African leaders who, in the first few minutes, think that I have a foreign agenda because I'm talking about conservation.
Where is that view coming from?
The fact that Africans have only heard from foreigners telling them why conservation is important. We need to hear Africans telling Africans. Remember, Africa has been managing wildlife and consuming wildlife for centuries. But once it starts becoming a business, that you are going to kill a pangolin from a village, transport it 200 miles away, put it on a plane, and export it. Already through that value chain, you've lost the experience and the local knowledge of how do you handle a pangolin and what's your relationship to it.
You've been telling me that until recently, most Africans have had an emotional or even a spiritual connection to animals, particular animals too, depending on where they're from.
Absolutely. I belong to a black and white Columbus monkey. That is my name. That is my clan. That's who I am. I do anything in my power to protect a black and white monkey. All Africans are like me. And what we are losing is that connection. That is going to only come when Africans discuss conservation with Africans.
What is the Western, or shall we say, imported view of conservation?
Conservation of the continent is entirely based on science. And the history of conservation is not very good on the continent. I worked in Latin America. There, it's mostly about indigenous people and their rights to land. And in Africa, it's about protecting wildlife from people, which has translated into wildlife is owned by everybody and nobody. It's a public good. And we cannot continue to accept that Africans living next to national parks value a chicken more than a leopard or a rhino.
Why do they place that sort of lesser value on wildlife?
Why? If you have a goat, you can marry. If you have two pigs, you can buy land. But you cannot pay medical bills because you live next to a rhino. The rhino definitely has more value than a chicken. But how do you get Africans to value a rhino more than a chicken? What we need to do is to put that value in front of Africans because they need to see that direct benefit. And it's possible in the areas where we work, we have managed to do that with private landowners and communal landowners.
How does that work?
It is very simple. People who come to see these rhinos, they pay $2,000, $3,000 a day. How many chickens are those? In Rwanda, we built a lodge with communities. This is one of the highest-end lodges in Rwanda. Communities earn more than $500,000 annually from their lodge. To break it down for you, communities partner with a private operator. That is paid a fee. The community, they earn the revenue, and they've been able to sustain their families. In Botswana, one poor company hires more women than any other rural company outside agriculture.
So zooming out a bit, what's your message, big picture?
It's how we design tourism. It's how we design ownership. It's how we design relationships. What we are struggling with now is how do you scale it up to the level that actually supports more Africans and supports the national economies. But it's possible.
Kadu Sibwe Shabunya is the president and CEO of the African Wildlife Foundation, and he was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.